5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Model Moon!
The dark side of the Hoddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom.
On the September 29th episode of Crypto Currently, we focus on finance and economics. We talk about Bitcoin dominance being back up at 70%. The inverse yield curve inverting for the first time since 2017, and Hong Kong's currency being pegged to the US dollar, and what Hong Kong's future is, and how it relates to crypto. You are now orbiting the dark side of the Hoddle Moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point of sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantechs. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Stand by.
Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iThesound.com.
Hoddle Moon!
All right, it's another episode of the Dark Side of the Moon Huddlecast, and today we're going to talk about Bitcoin dominance back up at 70%. We'll talk about the inverse yield curve in the U.S., and talk a little bit about Hong Kong and crypto. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, mate. It's good to be back on with you. I always love doing these podcasts. So let's see what today brings.
Yeah, we both had a good night last night watching the UFC fight, and Cormier got taken down.
Well, you know, a good night for some people. We had a good time. I drank like half a bottle of whiskey. That was nice because I've had, you know, about 12 bottles of whiskey on my shelf. And I was looking at them and I just thought, it's time to drink some of these. So I brought them downstairs to another couple in the apartment that we live at. And we just got into it and about half the bottle full. So it's pretty good. Feeling it today, but this morning nursed the hangover with the UFC. Because in Korea, you know, we're ahead of you. And you said that you watched it last night because you're, you know, 14 hours behind me.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Yeah, let's get into it. Some big news is that Bitcoin dominance is back up at 70%. And just to kind of give people a little background info, for a long time, Bitcoin was at, you know, 99% dominance, meaning that 99% of the crypto market was Bitcoin. It dropped down to about 95% in like February of 17, and then it just dropped all the way to 50% in August of 17. It kind of rebounded in October to about 60%, and it dropped down to 37%. And now we've kind of seen this reversal rising wedge. Now it's back up to 70%. So it's actually, for me personally, it's pretty surprising because when it was getting down to 30%, 40%, 50%, I honestly didn't think Bitcoin would ever rise above 50% in dominance again, but maybe it was all the altcoin mania and people getting rich, and people have kind of started to come to their senses and get back into Bitcoin. Josh, what is your take on it?
Yeah, honestly, it's pretty surprising, but then you've got to look at it from the macro perspective, I think. So if you look where it really increased, it was like 55% Bitcoin dominance early June, right? And that now it's up to nearly 70 again. I would say that that correlates pretty strongly with the news about the Libra, you know, because we were talking about Libra. And just like I mentioned at the first episode, it was the trickle-down effect in terms of people's understanding. I think that these days it might be even faster than I first anticipated on the show, and that people can just Google stuff and either they go down the Wikipedia like wormhole or rabbit hole or whatever you want to call it, and they can quickly clock on what is and what isn't legit and what is fake and stuff. So I'm seeing this resurgence in Bitcoin mainly due to like the quote unquote woke people that have, you know, discovered Bitcoin again and then thought about what they're doing with their lives and like, all right, let's get involved with the most ideologically pure form of cryptocurrency. That's my take on it. And then if you look at the opposite end, when cryptocurrency, markets were really pumping really strongly throughout 2017, that's when you saw the absolute like dominance of Bitcoin completely get crushed. So Bitcoin, I'm using CoinMarketCap for my chart, the Bitcoin dominance. February 20th, 2017, 86% Bitcoin dominance, followed by like about 4 months slaughter of Bitcoin in the ICO mania coming up to 19th of June, where it lost nearly half of its market share. In fact, more than half. It went to 39%. I think that that's when people were like, all right, just get out of Bitcoin, get into ICOs, let's do the pump, let's go for the moon, that type of stuff. And I think that this chart really reflects the mania of that period. And I think we're just coming out of it, really. We're in this trough. So from, let's say, end of February 2017 until now, we've been in this kind of trough mindset where, right, we want to pump it hard. We want to get as much money as we can. Put your money in some ICOs. Read a white paper. Look on LinkedIn. I'm an ICO investor. I'm smart. That type of mentality. Mm-hmm. So then massive disillusionment at the end of 2017, start of 2018, where people were just like, we got wrecked. Time to get out of crypto. And then a slow but a sure increase in the support for Bitcoin with the, let's say, the purists getting back in. That's my macro take on it. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, people are getting back into Bitcoin. I think if Bitcoin slows down, I think people will then deploy some of that Bitcoin into, you know, good altcoins, like fundamental altcoins, you know, on the first page of CoinGecko or CoinMarketCap, and they'll maybe try and diversify. But yeah, I think now people are piling into Bitcoin. And you also said that you think new money's coming in. Is that just kind of your feeling, or do you have any, have you heard that, or why do you think new money's coming in? Do you think it's a new institutional investors, new individuals that are finally catching on, or?
I definitely think it's new individuals, but of course the big companies have expressed a clear interest in it now with the Libra coin thing. I think it was a pivotal moment for the industry, actually, the Libra coin moment. It was great that we started our podcast with that first, because it kind of signified a new dawn in the whole cryptocurrency, you know, markets, the way that people perceived it. It made it legitimate overnight, essentially, by the world's number one social media site with the most amount of users essentially throwing their weight behind a technology which very few people understood and yet to understand. That was a pivotal moment, I think. So this is literally going to be, looking back at this, it's going to be a laugh. Like, we're going to think this is a We are going to regret not putting more in. Honestly,
more into crypto, more into Bitcoin.
Yes, we are going to regret not putting more money into cryptocurrency than we are doing right now.
When you're saying we, I hope you're not talking about you and I, because I'm all in, baby.
Well, I'm talking about me personally, you, and talking about like our generation, people that are woke enough to listen to this podcast. I hate that. Why am I using the word woke? But people that are, is this a word being stolen by, I don't know, it's coming to my my mind frame for some reason today.
Josh, I've been woke on Bitcoin since 2012, but if anything, I'm going to regret putting too much money into crypto. So don't worry about me, but yeah. Everyone out there, buy some crypto, baby.
Yeah, so I think this is the time. Well, there's always the best time was yesterday, and the next best time is now. So I can just see the whole way of this market going back to the pure dominance of Bitcoin, because you have so many companies in this space that are working to make Bitcoin a solution for its downfalls. So what I would say in that respect is they're going to work with the flaws in the architecture of Bitcoin, and they're going to work around it and accept it and look at ways of taking the Bitcoin infrastructure as a store of value, like the gold that we talked about 2 weeks ago. This is the new digital gold, accepting its limitations. So the limitations of Bitcoin being its slow confirmation times and fairly large fees once you do a transaction, but using it as a store of value with all of its benefits that we discussed as well, and having entire business models built upon that on top of the Bitcoin infrastructure off chain, which will interact with people in day-to-day life and give people much better access to financial instruments, new modern financial instruments, loans, access to even getting mortgages off your cryptocurrency assets, things of this nature. I think this is coming in the next 15 years. I'm really excited by what's going on in the last few weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's transition into how this relates to the market in general. So we'll link a couple of videos that we're going to talk about today, a Dollar Vigilante video and a video about the economic landscape in Hong Kong. So the Dow has plummeted, and the inverted yield curve has inverted for the first time since 2017, and analysts predict depression. Dollar Vigilante, Jeff Berwick, he predicts a huge depression, maybe the biggest in history. And the inverted yield curve inverting is pretty strange. So to give you one example, the interest rate on a one-year bond is higher than a 10 or 30-year bond. And that's usually not the case. Usually if you have some sort of government bond or savings bond, you get a higher rate for having a longer bond. So that is seeming to – the market is seeming to say that there is long-term risk in this. So it's actually – you're getting a higher rate on a one-year bond. So that's a little strange, and it kind of means something for the market in general. What do you – do you have a take on this, Josh?
Yeah, actually, I was first alerted to this earlier on this year. One of my colleagues at a company I was working at, it's called, well, I don't know if I want to out him or not, a good friend of mine, another British guy. He is a blockchain researcher, lead developer, smart fellow. And he was basically talking about this very thing around January, February of this year, saying that we're going to see this crossover, this famous, like, it kind of is a symbol for when a recession is about to happen, where certain bonds will have different interest rates with each other. But normally it's a predictable pattern. But once this line crosses, then it's a signifier that, we're due for a recession. So I've got a chart in front of me now that you can't see, but maybe I'll copy this and share it later. And it's called the 10-year treasury constant maturity minus 2-year treasury constant maturity. And it's essentially a graph which shows these two links intertwining between each other. But when they cross, that's when you see also simultaneously like various economic problems. So in 2007, it crossed. In 2001, it crossed the dot-com bubble. In the late 80s, it crossed, which I'm not sure actually what that signifies. And in the turn of the 80s, it crossed as well. So some people think that there's a strong correlation between these two things. Me personally, I'm not buying into it too much, because we're living in a new paradigm now. We're living in a world. We're living in a world that isn't dominated by the United States of America anymore, although it probably should be. We're living in a world that's clown world, essentially. Like,
yeah,
a lot of people are completely confused about almost everything, and so what were reliable indicators in the past, I don't think are reliable indicators now.
Yeah, but that's not the only indicator. I think that's just one, but just a couple other things is that we've talked about this before. You know, silver's up to 17 an ounce, gold's up to 1500 an ounce. You know, we've had 0% interest rates for nearly 10 years. In some places, we're seeing negative interest rates. So we're seeing a lot of signals that we're living in an economic clown world.
Yeah, we are living in an economic clown world. That's true. And in all honesty, as a child of a baby boomer generation, I don't really particularly mind it. I think that our generation, I'm counting our generation as the same. I believe it is. We're maybe a few years in age apart or whatever. We have a similar worldview. But I think our parents' generation were the luckiest generation to have ever lived on Earth. And many of the decisions that their generation have made have been very short-sighted ones with poor information and very emotional decision making, which has resulted in poor decisions and poor outcomes for our generation. I think that we will be the first generation in history that will have apparently less wealth or whatever you want to call it than the generation above, or have to work much harder in order to, you know, maintain the same lifestyle or something like that.
Yeah, I think in aggregate, we'll have less wealth. But if you're in crypto, you'll have way more wealth than the previous generation. Right, Josh?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. That's what's driven us, people like us in our generation, to seek out these extremely, risky potential investments or, big upside. You know what the downside is. It's whatever you've invested, you can lose all of it, but the upside could be massive. So, that's not something that anyone would be compelled to do 30 years before our time. They would have been like, yeah, just buy a house.
Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty simple.
Yeah, and we always talk about how Bitcoin compares to fiat currency. And a couple of things this video mentioned is that it's really been the largest inflationary period in history. Since 2008, the Fed has tripled the money supply. And I'm not sure if it's the same time scale, but also government debt has tripled in that same time, at least in the U.S. And, a lot of people still consider the U.S. like the economic engine of the world. So that is another reason why people are going into Bitcoin, other strong altcoins, gold, silver, because you can't just print more or mine more at a whim.
Yeah, that's true. Now, have you been on the website usdebtclock.org before?
It's been a while because it's pretty depressing to go on it, but I have seen it just click away and just the money, just the numbers just spin like crazy.
Yeah, and it's actually like going into a casino. It's like going into one of those like Japanese casinos with all the slot machines in your face and stuff like that. It's really funny. But also, it makes you realize how much debt there is in the United States. But one of the things that I always find interesting about it is, the economy keeps on ticking over. Everyone knows this is there. And there are people that their full-time profession is to look into this and make sure that nobody presses the red button and panics, essentially. And, under certain presidents, they have more debt, which is generally the more of the left-wing presidents. They tend to spend and borrow more. And under the, let's say, the right-wing presidents, they tend to borrow less and, spend less and tighten up the purse strings a little bit. But none of the candidates, neither side, ever actually will bring it back to zero, because it's impossible. Like, it is, there's no way that this is going back to zero. But as long as you understand it's not going back to zero and it doesn't need to really be paid back ever, then it's okay. The problem that most people have is humans, as humans, like, if I borrowed $10,000 from you or whatever, you'd expect me to give you $10,000 back on the date agreed or whatever time it was, plus interest or something. Or if I borrowed your car and I crashed it, you'd expect me to at least reimburse you with the sum of to buy a new car, something like that. There's this idea that it's a zero something. But I think the really interesting thing with playing with cryptocurrencies and is realizing that all money is made up anyway. All of it is literally made up by people. And as long as there are enough people that still believe in the power of the US dollar, it is irrelevant if there's actually anything backing it up or not. And in fact, it might be harmful for us to promote the truth, which is it's backed by nothing, it's worthless. Because the more people that buy into that, but only buy into it in a very shallow sense, in the sense that, oh, there's nothing there, so I'm not going to respect it anymore, then it can be harmful. So,
yeah. Yeah,
I'm coming round, man. I'm coming full circle on this.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen issues with all the banking panics, the bailouts, the bail-ins, and ETFs. A lot of people are in exchange-traded funds. Well, if the banks go down, those ETFs go down too. So in 2008, there was a lot of panic around those ETFs. But you're talking about the belief in the dollar. In this video, the dollar will exist in 30 years. It won't. That's what Jeff Berwick said. Do you think the dollar will exist in 30 years? I mean, it seems ludicrous now, but I think humans think on such a short time scale that it could be possible that the dollar doesn't exist in 30 years. That would be, I guess, what would that be, 2049?
Well, it's not a crazy thing to say. Let's take it in the inverse and say 30 years ago, what did exist and what does exist now in comparison? So like 1989, probably still Sony cassette Walkmans were in all the rage or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if CD players were invented yet, but if they were, they were very young. I remember cassettes still being a thing in my house as a kid wandering around. And I think that when my parents got a Sony Discman, as it was called at that time, a Sony, like a Walkman or whatever, that was in the early 90s. So we've evolved from cassettes to CDs to MP3 players to no player at all to everything on your phone or your device to everything in the cloud in 30 years. And I think if you would have said that, they would have said, fuck off, that's not possible. So
yeah, that's crazy.
So I think in 30 years from now, I don't see as much innovation happening in the next 30 years as has happened in the previous 30, or the especially not the 30 years before that, from the 60s to the 90s. I think that we're reaching some kind of I think we're just reaching a physics problem now, like in terms of battery capacity and all of the research that's going into everything. There are billions of dollars into all sorts of consumer products spent every year, and the innovations are very small and very iterative. And I think it's called Kaizen, where that comes from Toyota, where they make very small but constant improvements in the software, or the even in the Not even the software, but in the product itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
We're going in that direction, really. But I don't think in 30 years it's inconceivable that the US dollar will not exist.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the US dollar in relation to the Hong Kong dollar. There's a lot of stuff happening in Hong Kong politically, financially, and with crypto. And we'll link another video here. Kyle Bass, he predicts that he said that
2008 to 2018 are the best 10 years Hong Kong will ever see. Just like you said, our parents' generation will have probably the best, had the best economic, I don't know, lifestyle. And now we're kind of regressing. And it's really a recipe for disaster. Just to give a little backstory, if you look back, you know, 36 years or more, you had the first and second opium wars. Britain ruled this for a long time in the 70s and 80s. There's a conversation started about handing the territories back. And the Hong Kong currency declined in 1983, just on rumors of a handover. And then the Hong Kong dollar, they pegged it to the U.S. dollar, which is a little strange considering it's it was a British territory. I don't know why they did that, but you still had the rule of law and capitalism, all the things you needed to succeed. So do you have any takes on that history of Hong Kong and how it's starting to change?
Wow, this is like, yeah, of course I do have an opinion, but it's pretty a shallow one, let's be honest. I'm not very well versed in Hong Kong, China, mainland relations. So I don't want to put my foot where it's not wanted or whatever. But from my limited understanding, I can see that, you know, Hong Kong people, Hong Kongers, whatever you want to call them, people that are resident of Hong Kong, they have a different passport to mainlanders in China. They consider themselves to be different from the Chinese mainlanders. But the Chinese mainlanders, especially the ones in Beijing, consider Hong Kong just to be another territory of China that is, you know, inevitably going to be brought back into the mainland. So you've got two different worldviews there, and they're influenced by two very different ways of viewing the world. So if you're a Hong Konger, you've got the British aspects of, let's say, parliamentary democracy being quite important. And that feeds into the free market in a sense. But then in mainland China, you've got the government and, you know, the way that they operate things in the Politburo, the party making decisions between each other by reaching a consensus amongst powerful people, and then that being passed down from the top to the bottom. So it's actually a fundamentally different way of viewing the world. And this is basically a hangover from the British Empire. I mean, there are a lot of hangovers from the British Empire, America being probably the best hangover ever. You know, turning into complete freedom without the monarchy, without this like kind of pretend god that's a human, which is what the monarchy is. And all respect to the Queen and that, but essentially that's what the monarchy is. It's like pretending that there are humans that are very noble and wise, better than we are. But anyway, Hong Kong was a throwback to, it's just one of the places that Britain needed to trade because it was an entry port into Asia, and you know, we're a trading nation. So
yeah, that's actually
unfortunate. It's unfortunate the way it's went down.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because it was a big port, and that's one reason Hong Kong was so successful. Is I think in the 1990s they were responsible for almost a quarter of China's GDP through their port, and now I think it's 2 or 3%. And so China, Hong Kong used to basically be China's port. So they kind of needed each other. But now China's ports have gone from, I think, 9% of global trade to almost 60%. Yeah. And so I think that's interesting. And yeah, it's a hangover from the
essentially
British.
What you're saying with those statistics is that Hong Kong has maintained its like income in terms of it used to be, you know, I think you said, what was it, 10%?
I think it was a quarter of China's GDP in the 90s through the port, okay, so, and now it's maybe 2%.
So it was a quarter, and now it's 2%. But what was the percentage of trade overall through the port in China? You mentioned two different statistics then. And then you said now that it's gone from something percent to 60%.
Yeah. So the one stat was in the 90s, Hong Kong was responsible for a quarter of China's GDP. Now it's around 2%. And in that same time, China's ports, the global trade has gone from about 9% to think about 60% globally. I think 60% of global trade goes through Chinese ports. So they have their own giant ports. They don't need Hong Kong anymore.
Yeah, they've got like Tianjin. They have Shanghai. Shanghai obviously probably being the most well-known one. They've got Macau, which is right next door to it, which is kind of like a Chinese Hong Kong copy. And then you've got Shenzhen right above Hong Kong, which was amazing. If you can ever see a time-lapse video for 30 years from the 80s to the recent history of the development of Shenzhen, it's insane. I think it's the most rapidly developed city in history, and you can see it because of the satellites that viewed it. Anyway, sorry, thanks for clarifying those numbers. What I was going back to then is, so it was 25% of all of China, and now it's 2% of all of China. Yeah. But yeah. China represented 9% of the world at that time, but now it represents 60%.
Yeah, I think of trade, international trade, is the way I'm understanding it. Yeah.
So what I'm thinking is, it's basically held its weight, because 25% of 9%, is approximately, 2.25%.
Yeah.
And 2% of 60% is approximately 3%. So actually, Hong Kong has still maintained its status. But the only difference that's changed is that while Hong Kong has maintained or slightly improved its status, China around it has completely, engulfed it, surrounded it, and made it almost irrelevant, to the point that they think, yeah, Hong Kong, enjoy yourself with your, two systems, one country thing. We're just preparing for 2047, when you're going to join us again. So
yeah. Well, also, but that's not the only thing that's changed, though, is so we'll get into this, but Hong Kong has also kind of gone from a goods exporter and service importer to the opposite in the same time. But what I really want to talk about is them being pegged to the U.S. dollar. So a lot of times we talk about the pegged currency, but we don't talk about the anchor currency. So if you're pegged to the U.S. dollar, in this case, the Hong Kong dollar is the pegged currency. The U.S. dollar is the anchor currency. So when you're pegging your currency to the U.S. dollar, you're basically saying, I will adopt your monetary policy, your yield curve, basically your everything. And the thing is that the U.S. hasn't been super fiscally responsible in the recent past. So, but Hong Kong was. So in this case, you kind of have what he says is, yeah, the inmates are running the asylum. So if the U.S. is being financially irresponsible and your currency is pegged to that, that's going to create problems. And another thing it mentioned is that Hong Kong had $150 billion in reserves, and now it has 50 billion Hong Kong dollars in reserve. And they've spent over $100 billion defending the peg. So you have to do this to keep them equal. But this currency board's doing this. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of money. And he also made a really good point. Well, if currency boards worked, Argentina would still be pegged 1-to-1 to the U.S. dollar. In 2001, Argentina was pegged 1-to-1 to the U.S. dollar. Now it's 44-to-1. So that can't work forever. You can't just magically peg it. You can't just lob off zeros of your currency in Venezuela and Zimbabwe and hope it's going to solve all of your problems.
Yeah, you make a good point. I mean, the last time I was in Hong Kong, we went to a bar which was underground, and it's a private bar. It doesn't even have a name. You have to knock on the door, and you need to be a member, and you can only go in with a guest. And, you know, I've only been to Hong Kong actually twice. So the second time I went was this occasion. And it was quite a nice little, almost a speakeasy type of a place. You'd knock on the door, someone would recognize your person. You'd give them a password, actually. It was quite funny. And then you'd go in, and at the end, you could still pay with your credit card or whatever. And, you know, I was a bit drunk because we'd had a couple of whiskeys and stuff like that. And at the end of the night, the bill was being presented to us. And it was about 1,400 Hong Kong dollars. And I had no idea how to convert it. And one of the people that was with me was just basically like, it's just basically take off a zero. Because, you know, it's pegged to the dollar and the US dollar is this and the British, he's another British guy. The British pound is that. So it's basically like one British pound is 10 Hong Kong dollars. So then it made it easy for me to convert it. But then I thought, relating back to you saying this, this has been a way that people have done it for, you know, years and years and years in Hong Kong, because it has been pegged to the US dollar, which is an interesting choice because, you know, it was a British overseas territory, not an American one. But I think that was an acceptance on British on the behalf of the British that, you know, the empire was over. It was like it was the final and most public declaration of the end of British Empire was giving back Hong Kong to the Chinese. And there's a great 10-minute film that you can watch on YouTube, and it details how that final evening went, where you had Tony Blair going and Prince Charles and a few of the royal family over there, and how they were all out of there by about 3 a.m. that evening, and there were no British troops on the ground or anything like that. And it was fully Chinese by the end of that night. So getting back to your point, it's fiat currency at the end of the day. It is a faith-based system. And until you get to that tipping point where just enough people don't believe in it anymore, that's when it can quickly come hurtling down. And I think that we're on the precipice of that being a reality. Whereas in the past, you know, there are ways to get around it. You know, you could delay it. You could look at the opulence of the city itself. You could say, look over there, there's a big skyscraper, don't think about it too much. And people would be like, oh, that's good. And then getting back to your point about exports, used to be number one thing in Hong Kong and services and how they flipped. I think that that's normal, though. In a developed economy, like if you look at United Kingdom, London, especially the city, like the UK doesn't export anything but services. Like services are what we sell.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people say, are you just polishing a turd or whatever and selling it on? But
yeah. But they've also made a lot of money. They also made a lot of money, I think, just exporting goods, but goods that were made in China. And they were just like the go-between. And they were able to get a little money just exporting Chinese goods.
Yeah. Now they've just gone to the port slightly up the river,
yeah.
Where, you know, it's that part of the world is incredible. Like there are, I think there are over 60, 70 million people living in that area between Macau, Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Zhuhai, that area where you're literally like a 50-minute ferry ride from Macau to Hong Kong. And then a little bit further up as you go further into the mainland.
Yeah,
I've got so many people. It's crazy.
Yeah, I've been to Hong Kong and Macau. I liked them both a lot. Got some custom suits there and did a little gambling. It was a lot of fun.
All right. I love Hong Kong. Great fun. Good place.
So let's talk about something maybe you don't know, and a lot of people, our listeners probably don't know. I actually didn't know this until I heard this when I watched the video. So Hong Kong is the most levered economy, has the most levered consumers, most levered real estate in the world. And we can do these point by point. For one, China came in and bought all the real estate. That's one issue. When it comes to consumers, the financial credit in the Hong Kong is 300% of GDP. In the U.S. and Japan, right now it's about half that. It's 150%. The U.S. has never been over 200%, and people say that's a problem. And Japan was over 200%, I think, in the mid-90s. So the consumers are also really leveraged. And when it comes to the economy, the Hong Kong banking system is almost 9 times their GDP. And we saw banking systems in Europe who collapsed, who are leveraged like this, or not even leveraged as much as this. So you've got a leveraged real estate system. The consumers are leveraged like crazy, and the banking system is leveraged like crazy. So this is also possibly a recipe for disaster for Hong Kong. And like you said, whether it's the US dollar or something else, things change. And Hong Kong might not always be this economic powerhouse, especially when they're leveraged this much.
Yeah, you're right. And just for the listeners that might not know what leverage means, leverage essentially is where you are taking a gamble on the future and you are betting more than you can actually afford to lose. So when you have a state of affairs, anything close to more than 100%, then you're gambling on the future with a certain degree of certainty on your own self, because if the opposite side happens, then you'll be wiped out, you'll be destroyed. So having Hong Kong at 900% means that one wrong move will wipe out that entire economy very quickly. And that's devastating.
Who's going to bail out the Hong Kong banking system? The US, Bitcoin, the Eurozone? I don't know who's going to bail them out.
Well, look, it's not going to be China, because China's also very leveraged as well. They don't have the, you know, the wriggle room to work it into any type of projections. Look, when I think about it, it's like the China were playing the greater fool fallacy on themselves, in a sense, because they were like, oh, Hong Kong's awesome. Foreigners like it. We own Hong Kong. LOL. Let's put all of our money into Hong Kong. Let the stupid foreigners keep on spending their money there. And then, like, we'll rise, you know, we'll rise with the tide, the rising tide, as Hong Kong keeps on growing. But now I think the chips are really starting to fall where they are supposed to lay. And you've got this ongoing trade war with, you know, China and America, which is really not even a proper trade war, really. It's just like, it's like kitty gloves. It's like mittens trade war. No one is really trying. But even Trump's like cack-handed trade war attempts are killing China right now, and the Chinese are they must be sitting at the room together, you know, drinking their baijiu with the circle table with the spinning dishes. You know, have you ever been to them? The circular tables with the, you know, it's a rotation. You just, you don't need to get up from your seat. You just spin it. Yeah. And then a new meal's there. They're all there, and like, they're just blaming America, not even thinking about any of their own actions. It's quite an interesting thought. Hong Kong is Chinese people thinking, oh, Hong Kong's rich, we'll use it, the foreigners will pay for it, LOL.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, not very deep analysis from the Chinese or myself.
Yeah, to use the word of the podcast, woke, I think sooner or later, whether they want to or not, China's going to have to get woke when it comes to basic economic literacy and figure out what's happening. So let's talk a little bit more about Hong Kong. There's a lot of other crazy things. Like, they were talking about doing a fractional reserve, but you can't fractionally reserve a peg. And also, the economic relationship is not synchronized between the U.S. and the U.K. And one thing he makes, a good point he makes, I think is a really good point and very succinct. He basically says, if the wealthy convert to dollars or leave, Hong Kong is finished, and he thinks they're gonna do both, because you've seen with the extradition treaty, people are fleeing, people are leaving to the UK, they're leaving to London, they're leaving to Vancouver, the US, and also you actually, when it's pegged to the dollar, you're getting a higher interest rate being in the dollar. So why wouldn't you, have both currencies and kind of protect yourself? But also, yeah, if they leave, you know, if the money leaves, the rich people leave, what do you have left?
You just have a sweaty island on the southern shore of China, unfortunately. I mean, it's a bit of a paradox when you think about it. Hong Kong wisely positioned itself as a place for offshore business to come to, give it favorable business terms, low amounts of tax on company accounts, give it the ability to, you know, trade internationally from Hong Kong as a base. And, you know, they were pretty open to that. But now they forgot that the people that actually live in Hong Kong might start to think about that same type of mentality, which is just go where treats you best. And as soon as the government itself stops treating the people like citizens and just as, you know, servants to this great economy or whatever it is, that's where you miss a beat, and they've completely, they've lost touch there. And I think that the citizens have definitely caught on to that type of mentality. And I could even see this in various chat groups on Telegram in different cities. There's one in Singapore, actually, that I listen into. I don't really comment in it because I don't live in Singapore, but I've been there a bunch of times for cryptocurrency conferences. But I was reading the threads and stuff, and a lot of the people were from Hong Kong who'd moved to Singapore and were openly advising others to move to Singapore for business purposes and for lifestyle, because Singapore and Hong Kong are very similar in the sense that they are former British overseas territories. And, I think it's quite important to understand why that's a valuable thing. It's because it's democracy, which allows people to confidently invest in a market. You mentioned it earlier. It's like the people actually control, they've got a stake, they're stakeholders in the society. But when you're in this communist land, which obviously Hong Kong is sharply veering into, everyone's just a citizen, a tool, but not a participant. They can't really shape the future, and that's quite worrying.
Yeah, they're just a cog in the machine. They're not considered an individual. And yeah, also, I think a lot of people in Hong Kong are going to leave. I think there's also like 85,000 Americans living there. I don't know if they're really going to get extradited to China. I don't think they would hurt kind of Chinese-U.S. relations, although they're not great right now. But yeah, I think I'm kind of curious to maybe hop into politics a lot. Do you think Hong Kong's going to resist them? I've seen some interesting stuff on social media. Like I said, I've been to Hong Kong. I have some friends in Hong Kong. There have been huge protests. There have been Chinese agitators pretending to be protesters. I've seen some interesting things with people waving American flags and singing like American songs. And I've seen like Pepe flags and placards. Do you think they're going to be able to resist this? Would the U.S. or some other countries have to get involved, or is it just kind of inevitable that China's going to slowly and surely swallow them up?
Yeah, the latter. It's inevitable that China will slowly and surely swallow them up, because Hong Kong is no longer a chip worth fighting for. Unfortunately, that's the economic reality. If it were the Hong Kong of the 25% of China, if it was, you know, that big piece of the pie that it used to be, sure, you could imagine people actually participating in and getting behind that type of sentiment. Yeah, but unfortunately, the reality is that nobody else has enough skin in the game to make it worth their while to try and get in China's face. And I wouldn't recommend it. It's like, it's not worth it. If I was from Hong Kong, I would seriously be looking at just other options for nationality. I'd be trying to research citizenship in like the United States, Singapore, South Korea, even.
I think economically, it's, maybe it's not worth fighting for, but I just kind of, for the people, I think it's worth fighting for to, you know, let them still have that freedom and not just be in this, you know, Chinese dystopian system.
Well, the thing is, there are not too many people living in Hong Kong. I mean, it's only 7 million people. And, you know, for Brits, there are only 30,000 Brits living in Hong Kong. So for Britain, it's like a non-issue, frankly, apart from the emotional attachment. I was reading a, what's it called? The Spectator. Do you know the Spectator magazine?
I've heard of it. Does Douglas Murray write for that?
Yeah, a lot of people write for that because it is not partisan in left or right. They just let anyone write as long as they're good writers, you know. So that's what's good about it. I think that's the thing about the UK in general is that, you know, we're open to opinions, left or right. So the Spectator had a piece about how to help Hong Kong, and the piece was, give them all British passports. Because actually, that's what they are pining for, is the idea of democracy. Now,
yeah, I saw a satirical website that said, give all the Hong Kongers U.S. passports and send all the U.S. socialists and communists to Hong Kong.
Well, it could have even been the same line. It might have been Spectator USA, that one. I don't know. Because I only read the headline and then the opening paragraph and then, you know, clicked on to something else. But it's really unfortunate that we're talking about this because Hong Kong was at one point and very recently, as in the last six months ago, considered to be one of the places where you would, you know, want to open a business, be a global player, and now you'd be mad if you put Hong Kong on your list of potential places to open a business.
Yeah, and when Josh says you'd be mad, he doesn't mean angry, he means crazy.
Yeah, you'd be mental. You'd be crazy. Yeah.
Or loco or loca for our Spanish listeners. All right, let's do one more thing with Hong Kong.
Pitch yourself for the Koreans.
Yeah, let's do one more thing with Hong Kong and then we'll maybe move on and wrap it up today. So one more thing that's really going to hurt Hong Kong, not that it needs any more bad news, is that the U.S. actually has like a yearly treaty that it has to ratify because it considers Hong Kong separate. And it gives them preferred trading status. They're not banned from having any sort of technology and things like that. And it has to be ratified every year. And it's also a big part of Hong Kong's economy. But if this extradition law goes through and it's shown that China basically runs Hong Kong, it's a clear violation of this treaty. And there's no way it's going to be ratified again. So that's kind of almost like the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, it is. And also, here's the big thing that, like, the, you know, the Chinese big power men in Beijing don't understand is that the way that they get things done in China is just get a bunch of guys together and drink a lot of baijiu and then go to the karaoke and like a nod and a wing and maybe do that for 3 weeks in a row and then you feel compelled to give in. That's not gonna happen.
All right. All right. Let's
this particular arrangement. So it's very unfortunate that they believe that their strategy is going to work, but it's not going to work, and it's going to be very, very harmful for people of Hong Kong.
Okay. Let's say I'll give you another maybe hypothetical question here. It's becoming clear that you have to escape Hong Kong. You know, things are closing in, there's capital controls, it's getting harder to flee, and you're a wealthy Hong Konger and you want to leave.
How do you get your money out? Through the banking system with capital controls? Do you rent a speedboat and fill it full of gold, like Peter Schiff would want you to do? Or do you use Bitcoin to get your money out of Hong Kong and escape?
Well, you know, we've detailed this for quite a while now, so I would say you'd be mad not to go the cryptocurrency route, really, because you can store an infinite amount of money in your mind if you can just remember 12 words in order. So that's probably the right play, because no one can it's very unlikely that somebody's going to stop you and say, tell me a 12-word mnemonic phrase on your way out through customs. But if you're carrying like 12 suitcases full of gold, they might have a word to say to you. So I would definitely suggest going the cryptocurrency route. But then it goes down, how do you actually acquire the cryptocurrency in the first place? How do you transfer your wealth from all the assets that you've got currently, presently, in Hong Kong? How do you liquidate them and turn them into crypto? You know, that's the issue. There's probably money to be made right there, right now.
Definitely, definitely. I'm not familiar with what Hong Kong is used to buy crypto, but there's always decentralized exchange. There's person-to-person purchases. Josh, do you have anything else you want to talk about today, or should we wrap it up?
Yeah, we can wrap it up, man. I think we had a good rant today.
All right. I think me and Josh are in agreement that if you're in Hong Kong, you might want to think about getting out. And if you happen to get out and flee to Providence, I hold a bi-weekly meetup where I talk all things crypto, and I can get you started on the right foot here, doing crypto stuff in Rhode Island and Boston and New York. Until next time, we'll see you guys on the dark side of the HODL moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the HODL Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com.
HODL Moon!